Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn. We're here today with Vitaly Katsanelson, CEO of a well-known investment firm in Colorado and author. Vitaly is Russian-born, American by choice, and writes a newsletter that combines life, investing, classical music, just about anything, you name it, that's very, very popular out there. He also has a special section about Ukraine because he has a lot of contacts and friends over there and receives a lot of information about Ukraine. He's very knowledgeable on it. I'm hoping he can fill us in on why Putin started this war, what the Ukrainian people are doing about it, and what the future looks like to them. First of all, Vitaly, I want you to know there's a tremendous amount of support for Ukraine's bid for freedom.
Absolutely.
It's good to have you with us today. In light of current events, how do you see the timing of this invasion? Why now?
I was born in Russia. However, three quarters of my ancestors are from Belarus, and one quarter are from Ukraine. So even though, in all honesty, I've never been to Ukraine or Belarus, you know, in my life. So when I grew up, so there are a couple of things I need to add some context to this war. So when I grew up in Soviet Union, we were all Russians, meaning that. And I don't mean it in the way I say it now, it sounds horrible actually, because, you know, but at the time we were basically kind of all the same. Like, you know, I had a lot of friends who came from Ukraine, but I would not even know that because we share the same language, same culture. I could not, even today I have friends in the United States who are, and I say Russian, I keep discovering a lot of them came from different parts of Soviet Union, but it's just, it was like one big melting pot. And so when this war started, I was shocked because this is like a cousin fighting cousin without real provocation. And it's a one cousin turning Nazi on another cousin. That's how I see this. Why did this war start and the timing? Well, so my thinking on this has changed a lot. I used to think, or at least think that this is what Russians thought, that you know, the that the Russia looks at NATO as a threat. And therefore, as Ukraine goes more towards the West, then it's become strategic threat to Russia. And, you know, and Ukraine obviously joining NATO, so suddenly you have a NATO on Russian borders, and, you know, one of the biggest borders it has. That's what I used to think. And then I realized I was completely wrong about this, because that was an excuse, a cover story. Because if you think about NATO, until this war, it was basically a sclerotic organization, because it didn't have a purpose, right? Because its purpose was to fight, to basically a defensive alliance, underline this, defensive alliance that was there to protect countries in Europe and the United States from Russia. But I want to think about Europe, and you know, usually don't think about it this way, but United States is a 50 little countries, which is, you know, kind of become one country. While you look at Europe, it's actually a lot of little countries that are actually their own countries. So that allow that. So if Russia decided to invade Estonia or Poland, etc., probably on its own, Poland probably would not be able to defend itself as a whole. You know, and so therefore Russia could, in theory, defend each one country at a time, and that's how the Europe would be conquered. And that's exactly what happened in past wars, by the way. Now, by having this alliance, if you attack on one, you attack on all. That's basically the feature, the Article 5, which is the feature of this alliance. Basically, that protects Europe from Russian invasion. The problem is, like, Europe wasn't really thinking about it for a long, long time. Europe did not look at Russia from a negative perspective. It was just another country. Just like Germany doesn't think about much about Poland or France or other countries invading them, etc. People want to go about their day and just go to Starbucks and buy a cappuccino, whatever. So what's interesting is that, in fact, if you look at the NATO defense budgets of European countries, all these countries spend less than NATO chartered, dictated they should spend. So NATO was not really a threat to Russia. United States did not, and the Russians get upset about this, United States, because they feel like they insulted. But United States did not look at Russia as a threat, because the United States has a bigger fish, you know, to worry about, which is China, which is, unlike Russia, that has been shrinking as a country just because its population was shrinking, because the mortality rates are so high. China is actually growing and getting stronger. So we focus on China, not United States. So Putin basically, and he said this before, he wants to bring the Soviet Union back. And he also never looked, I guess, and especially you can see this now, he never really looked at Ukraine as an independent country. He just looks at he basically looks at it as it belongs to Russia. And he wants to bring the Soviet Union back together. And Ukraine is the kind of, is, you know, is the first step.
Not an easy step, obviously.
Yeah.
What assets are there in Ukraine that he really wants to get his hands on?
Yeah, but that's the thing. I'm not even sure it's the really economic. I'm not even sure it's, I mean, there's plenty of assets, don't get me wrong. But I'm not sure it's even motivated by that. But let me tell you why it's happening now. So in 2014, when he basically invaded, you know, he took over Crimea, mm-hmm. when he, I forget the year, but in 2010, I think, in 2010, when he had excursion in Georgia, the world did not really say anything. You know, there were some kind of toothless sanctions, but the world basically said, if you want to do it, fine. But Putin at the time, at least, was smart enough to have a cover-up story so the West would have an excuse not to do anything. This time around, this was an invasion, and you called it right, just a pure invasion of one country by another. There was no cover story. There was a...
He's going to free Ukraine from neo-Nazis. NATO's been attacking his borders, and he has to defend himself. So he's going to take all of Ukraine away just to keep NATO on its heels. I mean, yes. How many stories can this guy put out? And Russians believe it.
Yeah, so but there's a very important point. These stories are directed towards Russians, not towards the West, because he knows the West would not buy those stories. So that's my point. And so what happened this time around, the invasion was such a blunt in your face that several things happened. First of all, in the beginning, so Ukraine actually, Ukrainians responded with so much bravery this time. And I want to point something out. If Putin did this in 2010, I would argue, in 2014, he probably would have marched to Kyiv and the whole Ukraine would be speaking only Russian right now. However, after 2014, Putin helped to create or cement Ukrainian identity as a nation. So that war of 2014, basically Ukrainians now got more united as a nation. So therefore, their response was much stronger. Now, they happened to have a phenomenal president who did not flee to Poland or United States, but said, instead of giving me a ride, give me bullets. Mm-hmm. And give me weapons. So I think they have a president who happened to be at the right place at the right time. I'm not sure what the response would have been on the previous presidents, but this one we know united the country. And and so the Ukrainians put up a huge fight. No, that's point number one. Point number two, I think the Russian army proved to be a lot. I think Putin was looking, either he had bad intel, or he's in the bubble, or combination of all these things, and he was basically looking for Ukraine to surrender overnight, and maybe he did this based on his thinking was based on past experiences, like in Crimea, right? There was not a single shot fired. But that was a different story. And so Russian army was not prepared. And they got, in the first few months of the war, they got completely annihilated by Ukrainians. And so Germany, if you look now, you look at Europe. And Europe looks at what happened. First of all, Ukrainians are fighting. And now they also look that Russian army is not as scary as everybody thought. And number three, this is important too, is that they realize, they may be the other parts of Europe may be next. And by the way, the war in Europe is unthinkable. Just if you think about the whole idea of having the European Union, I'm talking about the economic organization, to prevent future wars in Europe. These countries went through incredible sacrifice and a lot of added a lot more layers of bureaucracy just to prevent future wars. And Putin just broke that. So that's basically, that kind of explains why the war started and why we see the response from United States and Europe we see today.
Two questions for you. One, based on your opinion, how well united are Ukrainians? How many are pro-Russia and how many are pro-Ukraine, just based on what your knowledge of the situation is?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. Let me tell you this based on, let me give you one interesting statistic. So the Kharkiv, which is a city, like the closest city to Russian border, the Russians there, what you would call the, what maybe in 2014 would have been pro-Russian Russians, were fighting against the Russian forces as hard as Ukrainians did. So this was a surprise to Putin, to a large degree. So no, people did not welcome them with the, in Russians would be called bread and salt. So they did not welcome the, so those Russians did not welcome them, Russian army, because I think Putin has created this identity were some of the people welcoming Russians? I'm sure, but those were minorities.
We'll return with a Ukraine perspective, our interview with Vitaly Katsanelson, right after these sponsor messages. Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
And now, back to our show. I'd like you to take a few minutes to explain how you were basically brainwashed growing up in the Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia, and how that continues today in terms of how they treat their people. I know that Putin is tightening down on the media because he's feeling threatened. Their economy, the value of the ruble is dropping. Their economy is starting to fail. Their army has shown numerous signs of being beaten. Their mothers are losing their sons. Their people are becoming disenfranchised. But he's tightening down. Anybody who speaks up is being shipped into oblivion, probably killed or sent to concentration camps. And he's been tightening down on the media in terms of what news can actually get out to Russian citizens. Yeah. Explain how you grew up with that and how it continues today.
It's a great question. So when I was growing up, basically we had a one TV channel. You know, like United States had three or four, right? You know, ABC, CBS, NBC. We had one. Except all the news we got from this channel came basically from Moscow, right? Newspapers, we had a few newspapers again. Newspapers came from Moscow. And we were brainwashed. We were basically told what we should be thinking. So it's and the amount of information we had from outside world was very limited. So I grew up hating Americans because, and also, by the way, the movies that were made, and as a kid, you probably get exposed more to, more through movies. Americans were this heartless, selfish, greedy, capitalists that would poison kids, kind of thing. This is the perception we had when I was growing up. Now, when I moved to United States, especially with internet, I thought, well, you can't do this anymore, right? Now, first of all, there's hundreds of channels now, and there is internet. You can read news from anywhere. Now, but what happened is this: over time, Putin basically, the Russian government, took control over all TV stations. So today, all the news come from the TV that you see on TV. Basically, comes from Kremlin. It's a direct link. It's basically you're watching Kremlin news. Now, same thing with newspapers. And so there used to be a few opposing newspapers and radio stations. They were gone. Now they're gone. But even before then, even before this war, even when they had opposing newspaper, when they had opposition, when I took a marketing class at CU Denver, I was taught that for you to remember a message, you have to hear it at least six times. This was 20 plus years ago, so now maybe you have to hear it 30 times. I don't know what the number is now, because there's so much more information we're getting now. However, if you work all day long, you come home, what you do, you turn on TV. And on TV, you see Putin, this hardworking, almost like a Marvel kind of hero, shirtless hero on a horse or hockey plane.
Modern Peter the Great.
Yes. By the way, that's how he imagines himself. Yes. Who basically is thinking about the health of the country. And like you can see them, like now you see him sitting in front of these big tables, etc. But before this, you would see him sitting right next to a minister of agriculture or something, and telling him how important the agriculture is for Russia, and how, and his staff on that minister. And you know that's all faked. You know, it's all, you know, they just had vodka before this, and you know, and hookers. I don't know, but whatever. But
is it true Putin wrestles alligators too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure he does everything. But anyway, I'm sure he walks on the water as well. But the point I want to make is that if you watch this TV long enough, the message you get that this person is really looking out for the best interests of the country. What's also important to understand, over the last 20, like when I left Russia in 1991, it was basically turning into a democracy. And when Putin was elected, you can argue it was a democracy. I mean, in democracies, it's kind of limited. It's a spectrum. But I would argue it was a democracy, still being in the spectrum of a democracy. But Russians have this flaw. They fall in love with their leaders. They just love them. Americans, we love to criticize and hate our leaders. Russians love them to death. So over time, Putin asked for a little bit more power. And every single time they gave it to him. So when he got elected, you had the governors of each area were elected locally. He started, you know, he asked for the power to appoint them. So that happened. Then over time, he asked for the terms to be not for every 4 years for the president, but every 6 years. So they did this. And there's a lot more things like this that I'm not even aware of. But today he basically got to the point where he has an absolute power. Okay? And as we know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so now he's ruling the country. And this is very important to understand. And by the way, until this war happened, I did not even understand the power. You would think, you don't realize how important the propaganda as a weapon, because you have complete power and you can basically tell people what to think through the propaganda machine.
Exactly.
Okay.
It goes on here in the States as well. I'm just not going to conflate it to the point where it's reached in the Soviet Union, but it happens here in our news media as well. And the government in power uses the media to do just the same thing. The difference being that if you complain, they're not going to send us to a gulag.
So I want to push, because I think this point is extremely important. And after what happened in Russia, and I've been thinking a lot about this, I realized the importance of free press. I did not realize, I kind of knew this, but now I appreciate it on a so much different level. So in Russia, basically, the government tells the news. It's think about it, if you're a company and you're preparing the financials, and instead of having an outside accounting firm confirming them, you own the accounting firm as well, and therefore the accounting firm will sign off on anything, right? Mm-hmm. Well, this is what basically happened in Russia. There is absolutely no second opinion, and it's only one version of truth.
What is life like now for Ukrainians who are now caught in the captured areas that Russia has taken over? What's life like for them?
Yeah, I read a few stories on this. And when you read this information, you got to be careful that, like, each side has a bias. Mm-hmm. But I think the story I read came from Al Jazeera. So I figure Al Jazeera would be they would probably in this situation, there would be an unbiased observer. But basically, what happens is that when Russia captures this territory, it basically creates its own border, which only goes towards Russia. And if you can't go back to Ukraine, they go into schools, rip out the Ukrainian curriculum, and they're trying to basically turn this Ukrainians. I don't know if there's a word. They tried to Russianize them. Yeah. They tried to Russianize them, and they turn a ruble into a functional currency, so you can't use a Ukrainian currency anymore. And as I understand, there's a lot of lawlessness going on. At that point, you become a second class citizen, and there's a lot of lawlessness going on. Ukrainians are not really. I wrote an article about this. Ukrainians today are not fighting for the land. It's not about the land. They're really fighting for their freedom. Yeah. They're fighting for the fact that they used to live in democracy, and if it becomes Russian, it's going to become kind of a Stalin-like state. They're fighting for the fact that if they want to speak Ukrainian, they can. They're fighting for the fact that they want to own the history. They don't want somebody else to rewrite the history. I have the saying is that the history is not written by the guy with the pen, but the guy with the gun, the guy who holds the gun to the guy with the pen, yeah, writing the history.
Good point.
So they're writing for their identity. And this is why Ukrainians are fighting so hard. This is why I was outraged by when I think Macron suggested that Ukrainians may consider giving up some of the lands to appease Putin and to give him an opportunity to save face. And my point was that Burgundy, I'm sure it's beautiful in August. And if France went to give up some of the Burgundy, I'm sure Russians would appreciate the wine and etc.
I have that one right in front of me. My advice to Mr. Macron: if you want to save Putin from humiliation, you wrote, I have heard that Burgundy is nice in August. Though Russians prefer potato vodka to French wine, they'll adapt, and you can benefit from learning to say "I surrender" in Russian. Well,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so let me tell you what I think about the war today. And I'm going to I want to preface it that I'm not an unbiased observer. So there is plenty of bias. And so I'm going to try to be as unbiased as I can. So on the positive side, I think Ukrainians have a will to fight. I think the world now, like especially what happened, I don't know if you saw, just recently, Putin came out and said that their objective is to change, again, they reinstated the objective to change the government in Ukraine and for basically, Ukraine to go to Russia. So this actually makes easier for NATO and Europe to continue to support Ukraine. So I think the support may last a while. I think from a support from the United States would last longer than it will come from the rest of Europe. And I say the rest of Europe, I'm talking about Germany and France, because those are the countries, especially Germany, is the one who is actually, it's hurting the most economically because they're tied to Russian gas. Now, and I think the weapons, the problem is what's happening in the war is that, and again, I'm a money manager, I'm not a weapons expert or military expert, but this is how I understand this. Ukraine army was completely overpowered by Russian army. We get this. But Russian army being also sclerotic, there was a lot of, most of the equipment was stolen, etc., all these different things. And also Russian soldiers did not really have a will to fight. Because what are they fighting for exactly? They don't know, and they don't want to die. So at the same time, Ukrainians have something to fight for, but Ukrainians are basically running out of Soviet-made weapons. So what's happening is that the amount of Soviet-made weapons declining, and the weapons from the West, first of all, the West was paying a lot of lip service and was not supplying weapons as fast. But there is another issue here, is that Ukrainians have to be retrained to use those weapons, because we're not talking about different rifles. We're talking about more sophisticated systems. that are, you know, very different. So it takes time to, you know, to train Ukrainians to use those systems. And so giving them weapons that they can't really use, it's, you know, it's a waste of money and resources. So I think we are getting to the point where Ukraine is now getting these weapons. As I understand, there's 10,000 Ukrainians are trained outside of Ukraine how to use more sophisticated, you know, weaponry. So I think over time you're going to see Ukraine becoming strong, like a very strong army. At the same time, Russia was already using tanks from the Soviet era, from like from 70s. Mm-hmm. Because I think they're basically running out of equipment. Now, in addition to that, sanctions actually, in general, like I think the impact of sanctions on the country usually very delayed. It takes a long time for the sanctions to happen. But I think the impact of sanctions on Russia's ability to rebuild the army very quickly, at least weaponry, is diminished tremendously, because they need to have, like, especially modern weapons, they require a lot more semiconductors, etc. And as I understand, even a lot of the tanks, they need to get the right steel from other Western European countries. So Ukrainians have this advantage, is that they're probably going to be better armed, when the Russian arsenal is declining. And again, I'm a very biased observer, so I'm not sure how much of what I just told you is a wishful thinking, but this is how I'm thinking about it right now. What I'm concerned long term is that the West will, think about Germany for a second. This winter is going to be very difficult for them, for Germany. Also, Germany is industrial powerhouse of Europe, so they need electricity. You can't make BMW cars without electricity. So there will be a lot of political pressure to end this war as soon as possible. And there are two ways to do this: either to help Ukraine as much as you can, to kick out Russia out of the territories, arm Ukraine so they can repel future advancements, or just drag it out. And it's so, or withdraw the support, I guess. You know, that's an option as well. So I would argue that most likely going to have increased intensity of support. And also, by the way, as I understand, Europe doesn't even have enough, European defense industry and American defense industry has to work very hard to actually make those weapons too. It's not like we have, they have some spare capacity, but not as much to basically fight one of the, it's the second or third largest army in the world, right? I'm not sure if it's how it compares now against Chinese army, but it's one of the largest armies in the world. So that's how I'm thinking about this.
It's been a tremendous amount of support from the West, especially the U.S. The U.S. was originally didn't have any teeth until I think Zelensky had his famous quote. He says, "I don't need a ride out of here. I need weapons." Ever since then, the U.S. attitude has really turned around. I know even Musk has provided them with a Starlink system for satellite tracking, which helps them with technology-wise to deliver weapons.
I think it's a communication system. It's a communication system.
And the U.S. has provided now a HIMARS rocket system. Have you heard of that?
So basically what's happened is that we provide them artillery. Artillery has its own limitations in the range. I think they'll be getting a lot more rocket systems. And Ukrainian strategy was actually kind of interesting. Instead of trying to, they are the David and the, David Goliath war, right? So they are acting as David. So what they're doing, they're blowing up warehouses that store supplies, store weapons, etc., and trying to cut off weaponry coming to Russia, because they still have only 9 HIMARS system or something. So it's still very limited number. Just think about it. Say you only have 9 this complex systems. Hopefully they're going to get a lot more, and I think they will.
I wanted to ask you about Ukraine in terms of they're a huge supplier of fertilizer to the world economy, are they not? And I've heard some people theorizing that that's going to accentuate the food shortage worldwide, especially in the U.S. here.
So actually, Ukraine and Russia are the largest suppliers of wheat. However, Belarus and Russia are the largest supplier of potash. So there are two main fertilizers, potassium, which is made out of potash. So again, Canada is the largest, and then Russia and Belarus are second and third largest, which is basically about the same supply as size as Canada. And then the second second fertilizer is nitrogen, and nitrogen is basically made out of natural gas. So natural gas prices are through the roof for obvious reasons, because Russia is the largest supplier to Europe, and at the same time, Russia is not exporting potassium, and Belarusian potassium probably is interrupted as well. So the fertilizer prices went up a lot. They declined since a little bit. But we most likely, if you are a farmer and you're either going to start rationing fertilizer so you have a lower output, or you're just going to have to raise your prices. And so we're probably going to see the food inflation most likely still ahead of us. And that's that's a big threat to poorer nations and to poor people in wealthy countries.
What do you think the chances are of Russia stopping their aggression, coming to some kind of a agreement with Ukraine?
So I think Ukraine at this point in time is not willing to give up its territories because they see what happens to their people.
Right.
So I think the only way this war happens is that if Ukraine pushes Russia out of its territories, or Russia, and I'm not even sure what probability to put on this, basically starts using nuclear weapons. Like it's just like, that's... I think the only way, like the more likely outcome, I think, is that Ukraine pushes out Russia, and that's to me, that's kind of the base case scenario right now. They just had a summit somewhere in Turkey or something. I forget, some kind of summit, and you saw this table that is the size of a hockey arena, and every single person, there was four people at this table, a different side of it, and so. This is the behavior of a person who wants to lead. He wants to be living. This is not a person who says, I don't care if I die. That would be behavior of a crazy person.
He wants to make himself a legendary icon. He wants to be the next Peter the Great or the next or the next Stalin. And apparently he has a hero worship thing going there for Stalin. And
he's
trying to convince how many Russians that Stalin was a great man.
Oh my God! So this is it. Yeah. So this is a little bit complex, but there's this some Ukrainians, not all of them, hold this guy, Stepan Bandera, as their national hero. Just to be clear, Stepan Bandera was not a good person, so there's no question in my mind, but. The Ukrainians look at him as a person who cared about Ukrainian independence. And a lot of times, if you look at somebody's heroes, so it's a complex situation.
Politics and war make for strange bedfellows.
Yeah. From our perspective, if you're Jewish or Pole, you can't see how you can't imagine how Stepan Bandera was a good person, and I completely get it being Jewish. Now. But at the same time, I can see how a country that's been beat up by its neighbors for centuries, when it has a leader who basically wants independent Ukraine, could become its hero. Okay, just that's the premise. Now, Russians are devastated. Like they are appalled by the fact that Ukrainians could have Stepan Bandera as their hero. And I was talking to them, and I say, I understand this. Like, I understand where you're coming from. He killed 100,000 people. I'm not sure he killed 100,000 people.
And for a while, he was a Nazi.
Yeah, yes. And by the way, when he was for Nazis, let me just clarify this. We look at Nazis today with all the knowledge we have today, as this incredibly horrible people, and for the right reasons, don't get me wrong. However, if you lived in 1939 in Poland, and there are Nazis coming your way, that's not how you would have perceived Nazis. Right. And here's why: because during war, there was Sam Zell has a wonderful biography where he describes how his family did not want to Jewish family did not want to leave Poland because they said, well, the first time, during the First World War, I don't know, 1916, 17, whatever that was, when they came to Poland, they were very kind and courteous. They were gentlemen. So that was how people looked. And also,
they were fighting socialism back then.
Yes, and this is a very important point. The Ukrainians looked at Soviets as an enemy. And there was a good reason for that, because in 1930s, a quarter of the country died from hunger, which went into history from a
Great famine.
Yeah, great famine, yeah. And so therefore, when the enemy is my enemy is my friend, well, not like the Germans were supposed to kick out Russian, Soviets. So that's why the Bandera, was friends with Germans. By the way, when Germans came to Ukraine 7 days later, they wanted Bandera. Bandera thought that they would make Ukraine independent, and they didn't. And he spoke against it, and he basically spent the whole year, the whole war, World War II, in jail. Anyway, again, I'm not here to defend Bandera, but here's the point I want to make. Stalin basically killed tens of millions of Russians.
Yes.
Soviets. I shouldn't say just Russians, but people in the Soviet Union through his regime, right? And Russians' losses, I would argue, also during World War II, would have been a lot smaller if he did not beheaded the Russian army, right? And yes. So today, however, you can't say anything negative about World War II. So in other words, they have laws now in Russia where you can't criticize behavior of Russian army during World War II, and therefore you can't say anything negative about Stalin. And they're erecting statues to Stalin all over Russia. So when I kind of debated with my Russian classmates who are completely brainwashed, who was telling me about Nazis in Ukraine, who was telling me how Bandera, they have a square named after Bandera, etc. I said, listen, I understand where you're coming from. However, aren't you the people who are basically praising Stalin as a national hero? Well, the response I get, they say, well, he was a complex person. I said, well, there was nothing really complex about it. He killed 20 million people.
He was complex. It's amazing what they're being taught to think over there. Yeah. You must be sometimes frustrated when you do get in conversations. Here are people people you went to school with, people who were very close to you in one way or another, and yet now their minds are just turned around.
So you and I in the previous show you and I talked about my book Soul in a Game.
Yes.
And there is a concept that I learned from Stoic philosophers is reframing. So when I talk to my Russian friends, I don't try to change their mind anymore. Not at all. Mm-hmm. What I do, I try to learn of how they think.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, I just want to understand how they approach this. Because I realize it's like, there was this great, I'm not sure it was great, but there was this show called Walking Dead. And I remember there was this scene I remember in the show where there was a zombie walking in the street, and the husband recognized that this zombie is his wife. And he runs to her, and she still looks like his wife. And he's talking to her, trying to get through to her, and wife is just trying to kill him because the wife is gone.
Yeah,
it's just the body that's left. Like a lot of these people, like when I talk to my friends, to my classmates that I you know, went to middle school is, it's like whenever it comes to the subject of this war, suddenly these people turn into zombies. It's like we live in a completely different world. They have a very different reality.
Vitaly, where can people go to find your articles and subscribe to your newsletter and to get your books?
That's great. So I'll give you a few options. Number one, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably like to listen a little bit more than you like to read. So we have a kind of a podcast where people, basically a professional narrator reads you my articles. And you can find it on investor.fm, or if you just look for the Intellectual Investor podcast. If you want to subscribe to my articles, where I talk about investing, life, classical music, and the war, I guess, as well, you can go to Contrarian Edge, contrarianedge.com. And finally, you know, I have a new book out, Soul in the Game. And you could actually, if you buy the book and you go to soulinthegame.net, there will be instructions for you to get 5 free new chapters that I wrote since the book went to print. And I'll be writing more, so you'll be getting more Soul in the Game content over time. So,
well, Vitaly, thank you very much for both interviews today. First, we did Soul in the Game, and I know your listeners have probably already heard that by the time you're hearing this one. And also, thanks for your opinions and your knowledge shared on the situation in Ukraine. We appreciate it very much. I know our listeners will enjoy it. And thank you so much for the time you've given us today. I know you're a busy man, and you've been very, very generous with your time. Thank you.
John, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.